Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Targeted Talks. I'm your host, Jordan Sava. In this episode, we are joined by Joshua Sabari, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Thoracic Medical Oncology at NYU Langone Health Perlmutter Cancer Center, where he discusses the significant approval of amivantamab in combination with chemotherapy as a first-line treatment for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutation positive non-small cell lung cancer. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Sabari. And to start, can you provide a brief overview of the Papillon study for our listeners who might not be familiar with it?
Right now.
So the Papillon study is a study looking at, you know, moving an EGFR and MET bispecific antibody called amivantamab into the frontline setting. So it's a randomized phase three study of amivantamab plus chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone. And it's particularly in patients who have an EGFR exon 20 insertion mutation. And these are newly diagnosed, so frontline patients. And really an exciting time because there have been no approved targeted therapies in the frontline setting for this patient population. And this study is the first study to really look at what is the benefit of using a targeted therapy in patients with this mutation, EGFR exon 20.
Wonderful. And what were the key endpoints of the study?
Yeah, so the study was a randomized trial, and the key endpoints here were progression-free survival by a blinded independent central review. This study did allow for crossover. So we did look at overall survival as a key secondary endpoint, but allowing for crossover, and I think about 66% of patients did cross over, meaning if they received chemotherapy, the control arm, on progression, they were allowed to cross over to receive the, you know, therapeutic option, which is amivantamab. So progression-free survival, primary endpoint, some of the key secondary endpoints here, overall survival, allowing for crossover, as well as looking at objective response rate, duration of response, and some of the other standard endpoints in this trial.
Great. And why were patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations specifically chosen for this study?
Yeah, so EGFR exon 20 insertion mutant lung cancer is relatively uncommon. It occurs probably in about 1% to 2% of people with non-small cell lung cancer. And again, we don't really have any great targeted therapeutics for this patient population. In a phase two study or phase 1B, phase 2 study early on, we saw that amivantamab had about a 40% response rate in this patient population. Around the same time, we were also studying an earlier generation EGFR inhibitor, mobocertinib, that had about a 28% response rate in this population and pretty similar PFS, about 8.3 months for amivantamab, 7.3 months for mobocertinib. And both of these therapies received accelerated approval from the FDA. It's important to note that other standard EGFR TKI like osimertinib or erlotinib or gefitinib, these are more classical EGFR mutation TKI, have really very little activity in this population. So, you know, these two agents, amivantamab and mobocertinib, both move forward into randomized phase three trials. So amivantamab plus chemo versus chemotherapy. And in the mobocertinib study, we looked at mobocertinib versus chemotherapy. That was called the EXCLAIM 2 trial. A lot of people ask, why didn't we include mobocertinib plus chemo versus chemotherapy? And unfortunately, the combination of chemo and mobo was too toxic. So the reason we particularly are looking at exon 20 patients is because, again, this is a group that has very little therapeutic options in the sense of targeted therapies. And the data from the Papillon trial did show us that, you know, there's a significant improvement, and we'll talk a lot about, you know, progression-free survival, improvement in response rate, and hopefully an improvement in overall survival as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that answer. And moving right along to the study findings, can you elaborate on the results, particularly the data on overall survival and progression-free survival?
Yeah, so I think the results of this study were practice changing. I told you that there were two randomized controlled trials going on at the same time, one with amivantamab, the Papillon trial, and one with mobocertinib, the EXCLAIM 2 trial. And we'll start with the EXCLAIM 2 trial first, because unfortunately that was a negative study. So in patients receiving mobocertinib versus chemotherapy, there was no difference in progression-free survival, hazard ratio of 0.98. So essentially equivalent if you got mobocertinib versus chemo. In the Papillon trial, this PFS was quite impressive. So median progression-free survival, if you received amivantamab plus chemo, was 11.4 months versus chemotherapy alone of 6.7 months, with a hazard ratio here of 0.395. And now we do clinical trials, and we've been doing this for some time. Now, I haven't seen a randomized control phase three study in a first-line setting with a new targeted therapy indication have such a robust sort of difference in the progression-free survival, nearly doubling progression-free survival when patients received amivantamab plus chemo versus amivantamab alone. Also, when you look at the response rate for amivantamab, 73% for ami-chemo versus only 47% for chemotherapy alone. And overall survival is still immature. And I think that's important to note, right? The maturity for the overall survival when we presented this at the ESMO 2023 conference in Madrid was only about 33%. But what we did see was a nice separation of the curve. So amivantamab plus chemotherapy did show a trend to reducing the risk of death by about 30%. So hazard ratio there is 0.675, but it's still immature. And this is despite a significant number of patients in the control arm, in the arm receiving chemotherapy, crossing over to receiving amivantamab in the second-line setting. So 66% of patients went on to receive amivantamab from the control arm, and that might affect overall survival. We still need to see the mature or updated overall survival for the Papillon trial, but so far it's trending extremely positive in the benefit of ami-chemo versus chemotherapy alone.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for those insights. And you talked about mobocertinib, but how does this data compare with other treatment options in this specific patient population?
Yeah, so I think the more therapies we have for our patients with, EGFR exon 20 or any, mutation population, the better for our patients, right? Selection and having options is always important. We know that unfortunately the mobocertinib study was negative, and that therapy has been removed in the second-line setting and clearly has not moved forward in the front-line setting. There are other therapies that are being developed in the EGFR exon 20 space, small molecules like therapy sunvozertinib, zipalertinib, as well as furmonertinib. Those are all EGFR exon 20 tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and we've seen 40-50% response rates in the second and third line setting, post-chemotherapy or chemotherapy and immunotherapy. Those agents are now moving also into the frontline setting versus chemotherapy on clinical trials, and we really look forward to seeing that data in the future. But as of now, amivantamab is really the only therapy that has shown an improvement in progression-free survival, the only therapy that has shown an improvement in response rate in the frontline setting in a randomized trial, and it is the only FDA-approved therapy, the only FDA-approved targeted therapy, I should say, in the frontline setting. So I think if you meet a patient with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutation in 2024, the Papillon regimen, amivantamab plus chemo, is the standard of care option. Clearly, there are clinical trials looking to improve upon that for our patients.
Perfect. So, how do the observed adverse events kind of associated with this combination therapy compare with those to standard regimens?
Yeah, so we know a lot about amivantamab from the phase one and phase two studies, and including other phase three trials and other combinations. And really, the combination of amivantamab plus chemotherapy, in my opinion, was overall very well tolerated. I think if you haven't used amivantamab before, the key things to know about the medicine is that it can cause an infusion-related reaction on cycle one, day one, on the first cycle, the first day you give the medication. That infusion-related reaction is quite common. It occurs in about 65-70% of patients. And, the way patients describe it is maybe some flushing in the skin, some redness. And I generally stop the infusion on that cycle one, day one, if the patient has that reaction, because if we continue, and usually it occurs at about 45 to 60 minutes, if we continue, patients can have a full-blown infusion-related reaction. Could present with chest pain or shortness of breath or hypoxemia or even rigors and chills. So very similar to some of the other, monoclonal antibodies that we've used, the anti-CD20 antibody, rituximab, or daratumumab, the anti-CD38 antibody, very similar type infusion-related reaction. But what's extremely interesting about amivantamab is the rate of the infusion infusion-related reaction on the second day, cycle one, day two, when we bring patients back in for the remainder of the therapy, is extremely low. It's about 1%. So I oftentimes tell patients that the first day is like a test dose. We bring them back in the next day, we'll give them the remainder of the medicine. The medication is then given weekly for a couple of weeks, and then moving on to that 3-week strategy in combination with chemotherapy. The other thing that we see with amivantamab, because it is an EGFR and MET bispecific, we see some of the EGFR-mediated toxicities, things like rash, dermatitis, paronychia, all very well managed if identified early and treated appropriately. So I tell patients, sunscreen with SPF 50 or greater, wearing hats and sunwear. Things like, topical emollients, creams are extremely helpful for patients. And if they do develop a dermatitis or a paronychia, early intervention, early referral to dermatology can be very, very helpful here. The other thing we do see is a MET-mediated toxicity. Over time, patients can develop things like lower extremity edema, swelling, which is common for all of the MET-directed type therapies. Leg elevation, compression has been very, very helpful in this patient population. When we combined chemotherapy with amivantamab, we did see a slightly increased rate of hematologic toxicities like neutropenia, anemia, but these are things that we're very well able to manage in clinical practice. So overall, the rate of dose reduction and dose discontinuation was very low on this regimen.
Wonderful. And I actually do think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think I saw COVID-19 was listed as a common adverse event.
Yeah, so it's a great question. On any study that we've done during the era of COVID-19, we saw obviously patients test positive for COVID. This study enrolled over 300 patients in a very quick time. It was a national study. Again, it was during the heat or the sort of central COVID time. When you look at the rate of COVID in the population, if you received amivantamab plus chemotherapy, you had a COVID rate, I think, of about 26%. If you got chemotherapy alone, your rate of getting COVID was about 15%. And again, it's probably just, related to how often and how long patients are in cancer centers and are exposed. We don't think that the amivantamab reduces or suppresses your immune system in any significant rate. When we look at grade 3 or greater, that's clinically significant COVID-19, right? Imagine, what is a clinically significant COVID-19? Those are, COVID infections where patients are really symptomatic and may even need admission. The rate of grade 3 COVID-19 infections was very similar in the amivantamab plus chemo arm at 2% versus 1% in the chemotherapy alone arm.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that. And in your opinion, what is the most significant takeaway from the study?
I think that the Papillon study demonstrated that we can target EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations. These were thought to be untargetable due to steric hindrance or lack of ability to bind standard tyrosine kinase inhibitors. This has been a very difficult to treat population. But over the last 3 or 4 years, we have seen that exon 20 insertion mutations are actionable. And the Papillon study is the first study to demonstrate a significant benefit in progression-free survival and objective response rate. Again, overall survival is still a bit immature, but it's trending positive. And it's the first targeted therapy really in the frontline setting for this population. And for me, it really opens the door for the study of many other therapeutic options, different combination strategies. So it's really a game changer for our patients who have EGFR exon 20 insertion mutant non-small cell lung cancer.
Perfect. And how do you see this approval impacting the treatment landscape in this patient population?
Yeah, first off, these are rare, right? So you may not see, if you're practicing in the community, you may not see an EGFR exon 20 insertion mutation every year, right? You may see an exon 19 deletion or 21. So, keep on sequencing all of your patients, and you will identify these patients in time. I think the impact of this trial and the FDA approval on March 1st of 2024, this is the standard of care frontline regimen for our patient population with this mutation. And I think, not only does it improve that we said progression-free survival, response rate, but there is a hope that the survival, overall survival, will be improved as well in this population. And it sort of adds upon what we currently had as a standard, which was chemotherapy. This builds upon that with the addition of amivantamab.
Great. And what are the potential benefits and considerations for incorporating amivantamab plus chemo into clinical practice?
Yeah, I think that amivantamab is a very interesting therapy, and we've been studying it for the last 4 or 5 years now, both in common EGFR mutations, exon 19 deletion and L858R exon 21, as well as the more uncommon mutations like EGFR exon 20. I think this becomes a new standard for our patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion. Again, there are multiple phase three studies ongoing in patients with 19 and 21 as well, the more common mutations. I think what we're starting to see is that this therapy, this EGFR and MET bispecific antibody, has broad activity regardless of EGFR mutation, which is unique and different from some of the other tyrosine kinase inhibitors that we've seen. So no matter where the location of the EGFR mutation, whether it be an exon 20, one of the 100 different exon 20 insertion mutations, or an uncommon EGFR mutation like L861Q or G719, or a common mutation, exon 19 and exon 21, we are seeing broad activity with this agent. But I think specifically for the exon 20 patient population, this really does change our standard of care frontline regimen. And again, if a patient is not receiving, amivantamab and chemo in the frontline, and they get chemotherapy or chemo and immunotherapy alone, we still have a approval in the second line setting. Again, there are also multiple clinical trials ongoing in this patient population as well. So an exciting time for patients as well as clinicians studying patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutant disease.
Very exciting. And you actually lead me right into my next question. Are there any ongoing or planned studies investigating amivantamab in combination with other therapies or in different patient populations?
Yeah, so it's hard to talk to things that are not happening yet, but I guess I'll talk more theoretically and my hope. My hope would be that we would be able to combine amivantamab with a small molecule, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And there are many in development, right? There are some early on in development that may even have CNS penetration, central nervous system penetration, and may potentially improve the durability of response. So my hope in the future, pending obviously any toxicity issues, would be to potentially combine a small molecule, an EGFR exon 20 TKI, which has a specific mechanism of action, with amivantamab, which has a more broad mechanism of action, targeting both ligand inhibition, but as well as an immune-mediated potential efficacy or activity with this type of agent. So that would be my hope in the future, is to see both an amivantamab-type therapy with a small molecule in combination moving forward for our patients.
Definitely. And then for patients with this specific mutation, what are the next steps they should take to learn more about amivantamab as a treatment option?
Yeah, first off, it's important that you get sequenced, right? You get next generation sequencing. I'm so, sort of dismayed sometimes when I see patients in clinical practice, how many people don't know what their driver mutation is? So if you have lung cancer, it's critical to ask, what is my driver? And ask your oncologist, ask your oncology care team, did we do next generation sequencing? And if the answer is no, you have to do it, right? You can't effectively take care of a patient in 2024 with lung cancer without knowing the mutation. Now, if you have an EGFR exon 20 insertion mutation, know that there are many different therapies that are in development, including amivantamab, which is now an approved regimen in both the frontline setting in combination with chemo, as well as a second line setting as amivantamab as a single agent. And again, multiple ongoing clinical trials in the later line setting, as well as some of the novel therapies, some of these oral TKIs being developed as single agents in the frontline setting versus chemotherapy. And again, I think my hope is to combine these strategies in the near future. But this study, the Papillon trial, really opens the door for that investigation.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. And what advice would you give to a community oncologist when treating and navigating a diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer with an EGFR exon 20 insertion mutation?
Yeah, so first off, knowing the mutation is different than a exon 19 del or L858R, a lot of times what happens is, we treat, unfortunately, EGFR mutations all the same, right? All patients will get a third generation EGFR TKI. And we know that that is an effective strategy for exon 19 del, and L858R, you know, exon 21. But osimertinib is not an effective strategy for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations. So really understanding that it's a different mutation. Also understanding that exon 20 insertions are not just one mutation. It's a group of over 100 different mutations that have been identified. So I'm often humbled when I get an NGS report back and I say, "Wow, I've never seen that EGFR exon 20 insertion." So, you know, talk to colleagues, reach out to molecular tumor boards, your state societies, and ask, you know, is this something that you've seen before? Is this actionable? There are a few rare EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations, particularly FQEA and LQEA, that are actionable with third generation EGFR TKI. So it really is important to drill down. What is the mutation that my patient has? Most of our EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations are really non-actionable with standard medicines, and you should be thinking about therapies that are specifically targeting EGFR exon 20. Again, multiple therapies in development, including now amivantamab, approved in the front and second-line setting in this setting. I think the key thing, though, is to explain to patients that this is an active area of investigation. There's a lot happening in this space, and hopefully in the near future, our patients with this mutation, EGFR exon 20, will be doing as well as our patients with the more common mutations, exon 19 del and L858R.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. And just to kind of conclude our conversation, what do you find exciting or are you excited to see moving forward in this space?
Yeah, so I think in the EGFR exon 20 space, you know, thinking about CNS penetration is a highly unmet need. You know, so combination strategies potentially. You know, it's important to note that on the Papillon study, patients who had active untreated CNS metastases were excluded. So it's important that, you know, if a patient has a brain metastases, if it's greater than a centimeter, or patients are symptomatic, I would radiate that, you know, brain metastasis before starting on the Papillon type regimen. I think in the future, we may be able to combine CNS penetrant small molecules with amivantamab. And again, the hope that we can take this really difficult to treat disease, the EGFR exon 20 mutant non-small cell lung cancer, and make it more like patients who have the more common mutations or ALK fusion, for example, or RET fusion, where patients there are benefiting from progression-free survivals in the 2 to 2.5 year range. And we're talking about overall survival in the 3 to 4 year range. So really making this a more manageable type disease for our patients in the clinic.